Blank swelled. There was something about brother stories that touched a nerve in her, too. Anyway, Alex tuned out. God and religion had ceased to have much relevance for her a long time back. No one had to tell her about darker than dark. Been there, done that, bought the T-shirt. It wasn't until nearly 2 weeks later, on a Wednesday, that she pushed out of Jess's house to find Chris waiting with Honey. "Hi," she said, genuinely surprised. "I thought Greg was going to be my escort from now on." Too late, she realized how that sounded and added, "I mean, I thought you were busy." "I was," he said, handing her Honey's reins. The slight smile he'd worn dribbled away. Turning, he jammed on his sunglasses, then swung up onto his blood bay. He peered down at her. "Now I'm back. That okay with you?"
"It's fine."
Her cheeks heated, but whether from anger or embarrassment, she wasn't sure. He said nothing more as she mounted and they started off, the horse's hooves thudding dully on fresh-fallen snow. She waited until they'd turned out of Jess's street before trying again.
"So, where were you? Out finding supplies?"
"Uh-huh."
Where?"
"Around." He kept his gaze fixed on the road ahead. "Up by Orin."
"Oh."
She cast about for something to say.
"Isn't that pretty far?"
His shoulders rose and fell in a quick hunch. "Not bad. Only a few miles north." She knew Orin, and it was way more than a few miles.
"You couldn't find what you wanted any closer?"
He hesitated before answering. She could almost see the wheels turning. "I remembered that Orin had this bookmobile." She was confused for a moment, then recalled Chris's conversation with the principal.
"You went all that way for books?"
"Well, not just books. There was other stuff."
"Did you find the bookmobile? How many books were left?"
"Everything, as far as I could tell. It was..." Chris's voice took on a wistful note. "Kind of peaceful, actually." She imagined it would be. A nice, quiet, very big van filled with books.
"How many books did you bring back?"
"All of them."
"All of them? That's a lot of wagons."
"It wasn't so bad. Peter was kind of pissed, but winter's pretty long and there aren't going to be any more books."
"You don't know that," she said. "Maybe we'll write them."
He looked at her then. "You wanted to be a writer?"
"I hadn't thought about the future much."
It helped that this was true. The most future she had was an expiration date. "Doc says you're good. Assisting, I mean." That didn't sound like a question, so she said nothing. "You ever thought of being a doctor?" he asked.
"For a while."
"What changed?"
"Oh, you know," she said vaguely. "I was keeping my options open."
They rode in silence the rest of the way. At the hospice door, Chris said, "Hang on a sec." He reached inside his parka and pulled out a slim, rectangular black case. "I thought maybe you could use these." She opened the case. Inside was a pair of women's sunglasses. The lightweight plastic frame was sage green, and the lenses were amber. When she looked back up, he'd taken off his own. His dark eyes were suddenly tentative, and his scent was different. Still dark and cool, but with just a touch of something sweet and tart at the same time.
"Apple?"
"They're sport glasses," he said. "The lenses are polarized and shatterproof, so they ought to be good for a long time." They were, she thought, very expensive, very nice sunglasses, and the right thing was to take them. To refuse would be mean, petty. But she didn't want to encourage or like him. All she wanted was to figure out how to get away.
"Thanks," she said, then closed the case and held it out. "But I'm really fine."
A sliver of hurt arrowed across his face, but was gone in an instant. The scent of apples faded as he took the case from her.
"Sure," he said. "No problem."
Chapter 57. She was such a complete shit.
She should have taken the glasses. What an idiot. When she gave herself a second to think about it, Chris had ridden into the carnage and chaos beyond rule, gone for miles to bring back books so a bunch of kids would have something to read. In the middle of all that, he'd thought of her. She could picture him wandering empty streets, weaving around dead bodies and dead cars, keeping one eye open for the changed or an ambush, and the other for the perfect pair of sunglasses for a girl he barely knew, and who, with her track record, might just throw them back in his face. Which she'd done. Even if she hadn't needed him for information, being mean just to be mean, that wasn't her at all. Idiot. Kincaid kept her very late, until almost 9, and when she hurried to the front entrance, Chris wasn't there. That was fine. A relief, really. But this was also the first time he hadn't arranged for someone to wait for her. Maybe a sign that he trusted her to find her way back? No. After this morning, more like a big screw you, honey.
Oh, thank goodness! A tech, Loretta, fluttered up. She was a plump woman with no waist and hair that looked like a pudding bowl trimmed around the edges. Chris wanted me to keep an eye out and let him know when Matt let you go, except I got busy and I forgot.
She felt a little jolt. Relief. She felt relieved, and that was even more confusing. It was one thing to feel like a shit. It was another to realize that she cared if he was angry at her.
He's here?
Yes, but... Loretta put a hand on Alex's arm and dropped her voice to a confidential whisper.
"He's over in the hospice wing. Let me go get him."
"I'll go." Alex started down the corridor. "Which room?"
"Delmar's." Loretta flitted alongside. "Really, it will only take me a second. You should wait out front."
"It's okay." Alex was studying name tags. Holter, James, Mitchell. She spotted the right room. The door, with its glass insert, was halfway open, and candles danced as dim orange flickers reflected on the glass. She felt a warm puff of air from the room's catalytic heater. Okay, good. She could apologize for being an ass, or, well, think of something.
"It's right."
She fell silent. Her eyes took in the single bed and the man lying there. He was withered and skeletal, and looked so dry and desiccated that Alex wouldn't have been surprised if a sudden strong wind was enough to shake his bones to dust. A green nasal cannula snaked over his ears and under his jaw. The only reason Alex knew he was still alive was because he blinked every few seconds like a turtle, slowly and thoroughly. Chris's back was to the door, but she saw the book and heard the low murmur of his voice as he read. Something told her to be quiet, to just ease on out of there without Chris noticing, which she did. Loretta waited a few feet from the door and beckoned for her to follow. When they tiptoed halfway down the corridor, Loretta leaned in and whispered,
"He reads to the very sick ones every night he's in town. It gives them something to look forward to. But you won't tell him I told you now, will you? He doesn't like people to know. He's really very private."
"No problem," said Alex, still dazed. "That's why he's always here when I'm done." It hit her again that there was a lot more to like, even admire, about Chris than she'd imagined.
"We'll just pretend it didn't happen."
"Good." Loretta looked relieved. "Now, here's what we'll do. You go on back and make like you've just gotten out, and I'll wait a few moments and go get him. He usually slips out the side door for the horses." She did what Loretta asked. Perhaps 5 minutes later, she heard the dull clop of horse hooves, and then Chris was there, on night, with Honey's reins in one hand. "Hi," he said, with about as much enthusiasm as she might muster for a cockroach. "Sorry."
"It's okay," she said, swinging into Honey's saddle.
They rode in silence for a good 10 minutes before she worked up the courage to ask,
"So... what did you do today?"
It being dark, she couldn't see his face, but she felt his eyes. "Why?" he said. "Would you even care?" Well, that shut her up. They didn't speak again. At Jess's street, Chris waved to the lantern that was the guard, and then said to her, "You can get off at Jess's. I'll stable Honey."
"I can stable my own horse," she said.
"Fine," he said. "Whatever." As they passed Jess's house, she said,
"Look, this morning..."
"Don't worry about it," he said.
No.
She reined in Honey and turned toward him. There was no moon, and she couldn't see his face at all.
Please, let me just... Can we not do this, please? There's nothing you have to say that I want to hear.
The words hit like a slap.
Then don't listen, but you can't stop me talking, she said.
Fine, knock yourself out.
God, you're making it so hard for me to apologize.
There was no change in his scent at all. If anything, his shadows got stronger. It doesn't matter.
But it does, she said, much more loudly than she intended.
Her voice must have carried, because she saw the hard white blob of light that was the guard flick their way. She lowered her voice.
I was a real asshole. You were being nice, and I threw it back in your face. You didn't need to get the books at all, but you did. You could have hightailed it back with just a couple, but you didn't. You found a way to bring back the whole stupid bookmobile. And on top of all that, you remembered I didn't have sunglasses, and you rode around that whole town looking for a pair. There are cannibals out there, and raiders, and people who want to kill us, kids like you and me, and you still risked it. So, I'm sorry.
Fine. I accept your apology, all right? Now can we please stable Honey? They did so by the light of a Coleman, but Chris did not, as she'd expected, remove Knight's bridle or lead his horse to a stall. Instead, he remounted and held out his hand. When she looked up in surprise, he said, "Come on, I'll give you a ride back." Without a word, she grabbed his hand and swung up behind him onto the cantle. "Better hang on," he said. The scent of his darkness had not changed, but when she slid her arms around his waist, she felt the warmth of his back against her chest. They didn't speak during the brief ride back. At Jess's, though, she dismounted and said,
"Would you like to come inside for a little while? I didn't have dinner, and I bet Tori put back a plate. She's always doing stuff like that."
"Wouldn't want to eat your food," he said.
"That's okay," she said. "I'm sure there's enough for both of us."
Jess opened the door just as Alex stepped up to the small landing outside the kitchen. "I thought I heard you out there. Come on in, both of you, before you catch your death." Alex could see the girls were all there, in their robes and slippers. Balls of yarn and a scatter of knitting needles littered the kitchen table. Ghost capered over to weave around Alex's legs and whimper for attention. "Jess?
Hey, Tori.
Sarah?" Chris said, crowding in after.
"Chris?"
Alex heard the surprise in Tori's voice, and then saw Tori's eyes pinball between her and Chris, and then back again.
"Jess was just teaching us how to cast on."
"Cool." He nodded at Lena. "Hey."
"Hey,"
Lena said. Her normally sour scent did not change. Tori started to rise.
"Alex, there's a plate in the oven, and..."
"She knows her way around the kitchen," said Jess, gathering up the yarn and needles. "Come on, let's leave these two to their dinner."
"Hello,"
said Lena. "Obvious."
"Do you always have to be mean?"
asked Sarah.
"Chris, would you like some bread to take back to your place? There are a couple of loaves in the pantry."
Tori started that way.
"Let me..."
"Alex can do it, Tori," Jess said. "As Lena is so fond of pointing out, she's not a cripple. Alex, there's hot water in that kettle, and Tori made a very nice crumble."
"Apple,"
said Sarah. She was studying Chris.
"That's your favorite, isn't it?"
"Yeah," said Chris. Thanks, Tori." "Come on, everyone. We'll get that fire back up in the front room," Jess said, shooing the other girls out, closing the connecting door to the front room behind them. Beyond, Alex could make out Lena's muffled complaints, and then something sharp from Jess. Her cheeks warmed.
"I'm sorry,"
she said. "Don't worry about it. Come on, let's eat," he said. She got the food. Tori had left enough to feed a small army, while Chris dug out another plate and silverware, and then set about making mugs of herbal tea. As she sliced bread, she said,
"Chris?"
"Yeah?"
"Thank you for remembering me when you were out there.
She turned around, saw from the set of his back that he was listening.
"It feels nice that you remembered."
There was nothing for a moment, and then, as he turned, she caught a fleeting scent of apples.
"Actually," he said, "you're kind of hard to forget." It was deja vu all over again.
After polishing off dinner and devouring what was left of the crumble, they sipped tea. They sat long enough that Alex heard the creaks overhead and knew that Jess had chased everyone upstairs. She and Chris didn't talk much, which both relieved her and made her crazy. With Tom, conversation just came. Chris was so quiet. Yet this was cozy. It was intimate. It was Tom all over again, but it wasn't. Couldn't be. If anything, it was a pale imitation, like a faded Xerox you'd copied about 100 million times until there was just an impression of the original. Tom was Tom, and Chris was shadows, and no amount of wishing would make Chris into Tom, either. And she didn't wish that, not for a second, not in 1 million years. She needed Chris, pure and simple. She wanted his trust, to make him her ally. That was why she'd invited him in, right? Right? "Can I ask you a question?" he asked, breaking into her thoughts.
Sure,
she said, pushing out of her slouch. Ghost dozed on her lap, his paws twitching.
"What?"
"Why are you carrying your parents' ashes?" When he saw her expression, he said hastily, "I mean, you don't have to tell me if it's too personal."
"No, it's okay,"
she said. Jaeger hadn't even asked that, and of course Tom hadn't known to begin with.
"They died 2 years ago, and they wanted their ashes scattered on Lake Superior. That's all."
And it really was all, come to think of it. No big deal. Why, oh why, hadn't she told Tom when she had the chance? But of course, she knew why. "Because then I would have told him about the monster. Once I got started with Tom, there would have been no holding back, and I just didn't want to risk it. I should have trusted him. I held back too long."
"Oh, was there something special about now? I mean, you could have done it any time, right?"
"It just seemed like the right time," she said,
and realized the truth of this. If she'd been back at Aunt Hannah's, she would have been trapped in the city, and quite likely very dead by now. It was as Tom had said, the right place at exactly the right moment. Chris might have heard something in her tone, because his eyes narrowed a bit, but his shadow scent didn't change, and then he shrugged.
"Okay, I'm sorry you didn't get the chance, but maybe come spring we could go up there. If you want, I mean. I would take you."
The fact that she had no intention of being in Rule come spring didn't make her hesitate for a second. If he thought she would be there, he and everyone else might chill out, and then she'd find her chance to get away.
"Thanks. That's really nice of you."
She dumped Ghost from her lap, and they gathered up the dishes to wash and dry. More deja vu. All they needed was a little kid hanging around.
"You're lucky you've got something left," Chris said. "The ashes, I mean. I don't remember my mom at all."
She handed him a plate.
"You don't?"
He shook his head.
"She's just this big white spot. She left when I was really little, like only 2 months old. To hear my dad grouse about it, she would have booked right out of the hospital if she'd had the chance. I don't know who she is or where she went, and my dad didn't keep any pictures."
"Do you know why she left?"
"My dad was a drunk."
He threw her a tentative glance to gauge her reaction.
"He beat her up, is what I figure."
Well, that explained the shadows. Any man mean enough to beat his wife probably didn't spare his fists when it came to his kid, either.
"Is that why you said he wanted you dead? I mean, you didn't say it, but..."
"Yeah, I know what you mean."
He sighed.
"Probably. He had 2 girlfriends. There was this one, Denise. When I was 10, she picked me up from basketball practice. I don't remember why my dad didn't come, but he was probably passed out or something. She was dead drunk, too. I knew as soon as I got in the back seat. We'd have had better luck if I'd been driving. 1 mile from our house, she crashed the car, slammed right into a tree. She wasn't wearing a seatbelt, went through the windshield. Of course, that was my fault, too. I still have nightmares."
There it was again, nightmares, like her and Tom.
"That's terrible."
"Yeah, I heard about it every day, dreamed about it every night. My parents are both dead now. Thing is, I'm not sorry about either of them. My dad hated me, and my mom left, His mouth twisted in a sour grimace.
If I could wash my brain and get amnesia, I would. It would be a relief.
Bet not, she said.
Chapter 58.
More snow fell. The weeks melted away, and then it was only 2 days before Christmas. Alex watched as her window of opportunity grew smaller and smaller, contracting as her vision and then her mind had when she'd almost died outside that gas station. She didn't give up, not exactly, but with every day that passed, leaving seemed less urgent and more difficult, as if her will were being slowly suffocated under all that snow. And really, was it so bad here? 500 miles was a lot of miles, especially when she didn't know what she was looking for or who was waiting, and with the changed and desperate people out there, too. No one was really bothering her. Where exactly did she think she could run to that was safer than where she was? She hadn't totally thrown in the towel. She'd gathered things, squirreling them in an old feed bucket that she hung from a joist in the darkest corner of the garage where she stabled Honey. Every item she added, a twist of rope, a book of matches, a jar of peanut butter, a scalpel swiped from the hospice and zipped into the lining of her jacket, felt like a triumph, but for only a moment. A flash in the pan, like the fizzle of a Roman candle. At this rate, she would be here all winter, or until the monster in her brain got tired of playing possum. Well, maybe waiting until spring was a good idea. She didn't want to set out in all this snow, did she? That was just begging for more trouble she didn't need. Her life fell into a rhythm. Work with Kincaid, chores at the house, rides with Chris. They were comfortable with each other. Maybe they were even friendly, though they weren't friends. After that night at Jess's, Chris had turtled back into himself, covering himself in shadows, as if embarrassed, afraid he'd said too much. That was all right. She had a few secrets of her own, and she didn't really want to get to know him better. She even understood why. Tom would, too. It would be like Tom giving the enemy a face. Do that, and you'd never squeeze the trigger. But she was scared. She was starting to forget Ellie and Tom. At night, as Sarah slept, she would lie still and try to block out the distant crack of rifles and summon up Tom's face, his scent, a flashbulb moment, anything. Yet the harder she tried grabbing hold, the more her memories were like soap bubbles bursting with every pop of gunfire. She'd have better luck hanging onto a handful of fog. Ellie was only a pink blur. The attempts left her sick and weepy, gnawing the inside of her cheek until her mouth tasted of rust. There was something wrong with her that might have nothing to do with the monster. Where was the Alex who'd grabbed the ashes and run? The one who said to Barrett, "I'm calling the shots now." She sure as hell didn't know. So really, maybe, Rule was killing her with the promise of safety. She was cowering in the corner just like a bunny rabbit, hoping that no one would notice. Or maybe she was letting Rule infect her, squash her will, who she was and had been, what she could look forward to. She'd never have let the monster get away with that, and there were many ways to fight. So why wasn't she? Because something was changing, again, inside her. She felt it in this slow, general slide into a kind of numb acceptance. Just like when I was diagnosed, it was that stages of anger thing. I was shocked, and then I got pissed, and then I fought like hell, and then I went numb. They called it acceptance, but it wasn't. It's what happens when you have only two choices, live with the monster or kill yourself. Only no one would let you kill yourself. It was a crime, which was stupid. Doctors couldn't help you. They'd get thrown in jail. She knew another girl, also terminal, who'd tried suicide. Pills and Jack Daniels. After they pumped her stomach, they threw the girl in a psych ward because they decided she was depressed. Well, duh. Try living with a monster in your brain and see if you didn't get, a little depressed. So there was no choice. None at all. You either lived with the monster or you did what she'd done. Carpe diem and run. She should run now.
Winter or not, she should get out before it was too late. Sure, she'd probably die out there on her own, but wait too long and she'd be lulled into the belief that all this, Rule, the life they'd mapped out for her, Chris, was her best option. She'd settle for what they wanted. Really, come to think of it, there were two monsters, the one squatting in her brain and Rule. Either way, she'd end up just as dead. Run, she told herself. Run, you idiot, run. But she didn't. She couldn't. She just couldn't. Chapter 59. Christmas Eve, raiders swooped into the zone. Whoever they were, they might have thought everyone in Rule was drinking eggnog and roasting chestnuts. That would be no. But Peter being Peter, and always spoiling for a fight, the patrols were ready. The guards kept Alex and the girls bottled up in the house, where they huddled by the wood stove for most of the night, through an intense battle they only heard, stutters and pops and the ripping roar of what sounded like rifles on full auto. The other girls dozed, but Alex remained awake, raw-eyed and so anxious her skin crawled. Her thoughts churned and tumbled, each new fear feeding another. Before, she'd had some half-baked idea that she might be able to slip away in the chaos, but now all she could think about was Chris, out there fighting, being shot at. Was he safe? What was happening? God, if they'd only let her help! When the weak glimmer of a cold winter's dawn finally lightened the trees, the woods were quiet, and word came that the battle was over. "How many men lost, Nathan?" Jess asked the guard who delivered the news. The skin over her knuckles whitened as she clutched a shawl to her throat. 10 men lost, about the same number wounded. 3 pretty bad, Nathan said. He was a grizzled, compact fireplug of a man, but his voice was surprisingly light, almost musical. Could have been worse. Alex felt the air leaving her chest. Lena's eyes narrowed to watchful slits, and the color drained from Sarah's cheeks. What about the boys? Jess demanded. What about Chris? Is Peter all right? Sarah asked at the same moment. Is he...
He's okay, Nathan said, and then his gaze shifted to Alex. Chris, too.
She wasn't prepared for the surge of relief, a great wash that flooded her veins and made her knees go a little wobbly. Too late, she saw Jess flash a quick, measuring glance.
And Greg? Tori asked. Her face was pinched with worry. Well, Nathan's gray eyes slid sideways. Greg got clipped.
Oh, Tori gasped, a hand going to her lips. How bad? Is he... Will he...
Doc says he'll be fine. Just lost some blood, that's all, Nathan said.
Can I see him?
Orders say you got to stay here.
It's okay, Tori. I'll go. Kincaid will need the help anyway, Alex said, but Nathan was already shaking his head. Why not?
Orders, Nathan said again stolidly. You'll be safest staying here. Doc wants you. He'll let me know.
From the set of his face, Alex knew arguing would get her nowhere. But why wouldn't Kincaid let her come? Because he didn't want her to see who he was going to let go, allow to die? Christmas morning was a subdued affair. No presents other than hand-knitted socks Jess made for each of them, because anything else was wasteful, and Jess thought they ought to spend time being thankful they were alive. While that was a little sucky, Alex was glad. What exactly would you give someone like Lena? Maybe a muzzle. In all the excitement, church was pushed to the afternoon, one big service held on the town square. Alex looked around for Kincaid, but the doctor wasn't there. Standing on the church steps, Jaeger launched into a long sermon about our men of Rule, like they were crusaders on some holy mission.
And our Lord has called on you, my consecrated ones, Jaeger said, his breath smoking in the wintry air.
He peered down at the rows of men gathered in front on folding chairs who'd been in the battle the night before, and now Alex spotted Chris, Peter, Greg, with a bulky bandage around his left bicep, and a clutch of other boys, so easy to pick out from the old men who flanked them.
I have even called my mighty warriors, my proudly exulting ones, to execute my anger. Is this not a description of our men of rule? We are the guardians of righteousness. The followers of Satan have become as beasts. They bear the mark of Cain and the curse of Ishmael, and yet we endure as the Lord's strong right hand.
This being Michigan, there weren't hallelujahs or anything, but Alex saw heads nod in agreement. When Jaeger called the man up for a blessing, her blood warmed as Jaeger clapped his hands on Chris's shoulders, and she felt something almost proprietary, a feeling that Chris was hers somehow, that his victory belonged to her, too. Then when Chris rose and turned, his gaze brushed over the crowd, found hers, and did not falter. For an instant, it was as if the world had stopped turning. Everyone around her simply melted away. The shadows hugging Chris dissolved, and there was only his face and the look they shared. And was it her imagination, or was the scent of sweet, crisp apples that much stronger, so rich it overpowered everything else? Tearing her eyes away from his was an effort, an act of will that was almost painful, because she didn't want to look away. Her face was suddenly slick with sweat, and her pulse tripped in her neck. What was happening to her? She couldn't have these feelings. Yes, Chris was fine, he was okay, he was a nice guy, but he was not Tom. She couldn't like Chris, she couldn't care about him. If she did, then Tom was gone, really gone, and she wasn't ready to let go.
Please, she exhaled. Please, Tom, please don't leave me. Please.
Her words were no more than a murmur, as insubstantial as the mist rising from her lips, and barely audible to herself. But she felt eyes again, not Chris's. She looked left and met Jess's gaze. Alex stiffened in alarm. Had Jess heard? No, that was impossible. She'd barely breathed the words. But Jess was studying her with that same calculating look from earlier that morning. The older woman's scent betrayed nothing, and Alex thought once more of how Jess was a little like Jaeger that way. Her scent was not like cloudy glass, however. Just nothing. Jess's scent was a big zip-zero, like the white spot Chris associated with his mother.
Hey,
Sarah plucked her sleeve.
Are you okay?
At that, Jess broke her stare and turned to face forward once more. Alex flicked a glance at Sarah.
I'm fine, she said, forcing a quick grin. Just a little tired.
She heard nothing after that, and only mouthed the words to the hymns. Jess did not look at her again, but Alex knew what she'd seen. Jess's scent might be a white blank, but something flashed across the older woman's face just as she looked away that Alex could read loud and clear. Satisfaction. And then it was the day before New Year's.
I'm leaving town this morning. We'll probably...
Chris broke off as Tori slid a plate of biscuits and scrambled eggs onto the table. They were virtually out of baking powder, and the biscuits looked deflated, like miniature hockey pucks.
Thanks. Where are you going?
Asked Alex.
Coffee?
Tori held up a pot.
Sure, said Chris.
He watched as Tori poured a dank black liquid that smelled suspiciously tarry to Alex. Even Chris raised an eyebrow. What's in this?
Chicory, said Jess, coming up from the root cellar of the pantry with Sarah close behind. Both dumped an apron of potatoes into the sink. In New Orleans, that's a delicacy.
Chris gave a noncommittal murmur.
Any butter?
I'm afraid not. What little we had, we used for Christmas baking, said Jess. Those milkers need better feed.
I know.
Chris snapped a biscuit in two. It's on the list.
Where are you going?
Alex asked again.
A lot farther than I'd like,
Chris said, around biscuit. He swallowed, chased the biscuit with a sip of pseudo-coffee, and grimaced.
I'm sorry,
Tori said. She put a hand on his shoulder.
I had to cut the flour with a little cornmeal. I know they're heavy. You want me to see if I can find some honey?
No, no, this is great, said Chris.
To Alex,
we're going out a lot farther this time, I think.
Most of the towns around here are cleaned out, virtually nothing left. Peter's thinking we should head for Wisconsin. Tori gasped.
Aren't they guarding the border?
We're going to find out. A week there and back, easy, and that's not counting us having to actually find something.
Then you won't be back until after the new year,
Sarah said. She sounded disappointed.
Nope, said Chris, and then looked up as Lena hip-butted the kitchen door with an armload of firewood. Probably not.
Probably not what? Asked Lena.
Chris and Peter won't be here for New Year's, Tori said. They may have to cross over into Wisconsin for supplies, if they can get across the border. It's not fair. They fight on Christmas Eve, and now this.
Lena did her usual eye roll, but this time Alex agreed with her. Life hadn't exactly been fair, in case Tori hadn't noticed. Chris said,
If you guys want something special, make a list. I can't promise anything, but
real coffee, Lena said. Failing that, a one-way ticket out of here would be nice.
Here we go again, said Sarah.
Alex was tired of that subject already.
I don't understand, Chris. You said there are other towns, right? And there are the various groups of raiders you guys keep fighting, right? So why don't we, I don't know, organize, or trade, or maybe just share and share alike? That way you guys don't have to worry about getting shot all the time, and you don't have to travel as far.
She remembered the discussion she'd had with Tom about this.
What you're doing is kind of inefficient.
She has a point, said Jess. She didn't look up from scrubbing potatoes. Chris looked uncomfortable.
That's really not my call.
Why not?
Alex persisted.
Well, first off, we'd have to have something worth trading, Sarah pointed out. We've got supplies, we've got tools and weapons, and
we're not going to trade weapons or tools, Chris said flatly. That's like handing them the keys to the front door.
Well, what about clothes?
Alex persisted. Or soap, or candles, or lanterns, or...
Or us, Lena said.
She dumped wood in a loud clatter.
How much you think I'm worth, Chris?
Chris looked like he'd been slapped.
Lena, it's not like,
oh, bullshit. We're your precious little baby makers. So what do you think you can buy with me?
I guess that depends on when the guy gets tired.
You know, Jess interrupted, we could do with more wood.
Right, I forgot. Your house, your rules, Lena said, and banged out of the kitchen.
Tori broke the silence first.
More coffee, Chris?
No.
His cheeks were splashed with scarlet. He wouldn't meet Alex's eyes.
No, I probably shouldn't.
Chris, Sarah said gently, she didn't mean that. She's not angry at you.
And Alex thought, oh, yes, she is. Lena was rude, she was obnoxious, but she was deliberately baiting Chris, really pushing it. The question was, why? 15 minutes later, Alex shrugged into her parka and scuffed outside. It was snowing again, big powdery flakes spinning slowly as feathers. The snow was deep, an easy 2.5 feet, and hard on Honey. For the past few days, Chris had taken her to and from the hospice in a Portland cutter, and he'd just left the house 5 minutes before her. Alex expected to see him in the dark blue cutter, but only Nathan was there, holding the reins of a white dray.
"Where's Chris?"
she asked as Nathan's border collie pranced up to be petted. Nathan chinned in the general direction of the backyard.
"Headed that way when he came out. Said he'd be right back."
Puzzled, Alex retraced her steps, then ducked around the house. Jess's yard was very large, about an acre before it blended into the woods. She spotted Chris in the far left corner by the woodpile, with Lena. Whatever she'd been about to say dried up on her tongue. Chris and Lena were facing each other, and Lena's arms jerked in emphatic, angry gestures. Fighting with Chris? Knowing Lena, that was a safe bet. But after that little scene in the kitchen, why would Chris go out of his way to talk to her? Alex was too far away to hear, but she saw Chris shake his head and start to turn away. In the next instant, Lena grabbed his arm and flung herself into Chris so hard he staggered, and then she was threading her arms around his neck, pressing against him.
I don't want to see this.
Stunned, Alex stumbled back, her boots tangling, and she let go of a startled, involuntary yip. Chris's head darted around, and then he was trying to disengage from Lena, pulling at her arms. He might even have called her name, but Alex wasn't waiting around. Floundering back up the walk toward the street, eyes smarting, she couldn't breathe. Her chest was tight, like someone had punched all the air from her lungs. Just get honey and go. But no, she couldn't. Nathan would stop her because she wasn't allowed to go anywhere without an escort. Well, that was all right. That was fine. She didn't care what was going on between Chris and Lena. She didn't care. You find him? Asked Nathan as she clawed her way onto the cutter.
Yeah.
As she settled herself onto the seat, she saw Chris wheel around the house. He was moving fast, and she smelled him coming. No apples this time, or shadows, but a roiling, angry storm cloud. She looked away as he clambered aboard, and then, with a crisp snap of the reins, Chris urged the dray to a trot, and they glided off. He was silent, a black boiling wall pressing the air between them. Her heart was hammering, and her stomach was twisting and fisting like her hands.
"It's not what you think," Chris said tightly.
"I don't care," she said, not daring to look at him. "It's none of my business."
He said nothing. Their sleigh swept past the village hall, where a knot of rural men were marching a cluster of refugees inside. And then they were heading northeast, down the approach road to the hospice. The forest closed in and echoed with the clop of horse hooves. Alex watched the snow fall, felt it melt on her cheeks like tears. Chris cleared his throat.
"Alex,
it doesn't matter, Chris."
"No,"
he said.
"It does.
I just can't."
"Can't what? Explain?"
She darted a look at his face. His skin was tight and white as snow, except for the two hectic stains of color along his high cheekbones. The scent of his shadows was stronger, as if they were closing around, trying to protect him somehow.
"What's there to explain, Chris? We had sex ed in sixth grade, so if you need any pointers..."
She heard the cruelty in her voice and choked back the rest. What the hell was she doing? She didn't care.
"You don't understand," he said. "You don't owe me any explanations."
"But I wish I could," he said.
She heard his misery and something more, disgust.
"God, this is so messed up."
"Yeah, you think?"
The frustration was pillowing in her head like hot steam. Any second, the top of her head would pop like a cork.
"You're realizing this now?"
"Please, I don't want to fight with you."
"You know, it's fine, Chris, really. It's your town. If you want to screw Lena, choose her to go play house with, do it. Stop!"
His eyes closed, and the small muscles of his jaw twitched and jumped.
"Please, Alex, I don't want Lena. I never have." "Yeah? Well, you better clue her in. Will you shut up?"
With an abrupt twitch of his wrists, he jerked back on the dray's reins. The sleigh slewed, and she had to grab onto the side to keep from tumbling out. But then he was grabbing her by the arms and shaking her.
"Do you think I want this? Do you think I want her? Don't you? No, don't answer that. I don't care what or who you want," she spat. And then she slapped him across the face, hard and fast, the sound as crisp as the snap of a dried bone.
The sound broke something inside her, too, and she felt a sudden hot rush of shame as he gasped and his hands fell away. The sting in her hand burned like acid.
"Chris," she said. "Chris, I'm sorry. I'm..." "Why can't you like me?"
he said, his voice breaking. His scent steamed then, hot and heady with a welter of contradictions, apples and fire and the electric roil of those cold black shadows.
"Why can't you like me just a little?"
She would never know how she might have answered, because he never gave her the chance. Instead, he kissed her. Chapter 60. It was not like Tom at all. This was more like a bomb. She felt her body go rigid with surprise, and then the quick lurch of her heart and a sudden breathlessness. For an instant, just an instant, she could have pushed him away, but she didn't. A stunning white heat scorched the thought right out of her brain, and then he was pressed against her, and her body was tingling, and she felt his hunger, his need, and she'd grabbed the lapels of his coat because she was starving for his touch. She couldn't get close enough, and the scent of spiced apples made her feverish and dizzy.
The kiss went on forever. It lasted for a second. She wasn't sure who broke it off. Maybe both of them did at the same time, or neither of them. He let her go.
Oh, I'm sorry. God, I'm so sorry, he said, his voice ragged. Please, don't hate me. I just...
It's okay, she said. The red splotch of her hand stood out on his cheek like a brand. Her lips felt bruised and swollen.
I shouldn't have egged you on. I was just mad.
I think... Chris leaned back, his chest still heaving. I think maybe when I get back, I shouldn't be around you anymore. I can't think. When I'm out there, all I can think about is here and being with you. I just...
God, Alex, I'm just trying to protect you.
Her automatic rebuttal, I don't need your protection, jammed up behind her teeth. He was telling the truth. She could smell it. This was like when he'd given her the sunglasses, only this time she held his feelings in the cup of her hands. You know what I worry about? I worry that when I come back, you'll find some loophole, something we've overlooked, and then you'll be gone. And I don't think... Chris closed his eyes.
Please say something.
I'm so sorry. She reached for his face, touched the mark she'd left there.
I don't hate you, Chris.
He gave a sad half-laugh. But you don't like me.
I kissed you back, she said.
After I surprised you, after I forced you.
No, you didn't force me. I think...
She pulled in a shaking breath.
I think I'm afraid to like you.
His surprise and then the hope on his face were almost painful, and she had to bite her lip to keep from bursting into tears. Her hand was still on his cheek, and he covered it now with his own.
Why?
He asked. A sob tried to push its way out of her mouth.
Because it means giving up. It means that you've closed up all the loopholes, and there's nowhere else for me to go.
But Alex, the rules exist for a reason. They're there to keep you safe.
Then why does Jess think they need to change?
Alex... He moved closer, and when he gathered her up, she didn't resist. I want to protect you. I want to take care of you. If you stayed, would that be so bad? Her hands hooked onto his jacket, and she held on.
No,
she said. They rode in silence the rest of the way, but she stayed close, their thighs touching, her hand looped through the crook of his elbow. The snow was thicker and beginning to swirl by the time they got to the hospice. When the sleigh had coasted to a stop, however, she did not jump down. Beyond the glass doors, she could see the hospice guard watching, his hand on the push bar to let her in. She turned to Chris.
How long do you think you'll be gone?
A while, maybe. A couple weeks. His mouth moved in a tense, uncertain, lopsided smile. Snow clung to his dark hair. Don't worry. I'll have someone here for you.
I'm not worried about me.
She took his hand, and their fingers laced.
When you get back.
Yeah, he said. This time, when they kissed, they were only apples, sweet and crisp and right. That afternoon, one of the nurses dashed out of the treatment room for something or other and left a clutch of fresh instruments spread on a tray. One was a jiggly saw, a coil of wire that could cut through bone, or a tree, or a man's neck. The saw was 16 inches long, with two handles, coiled. She could slip it into her jeans. A saw like that would come in handy on the road for a girl on the run. She left the saw where it was. Chapter 61 2 weeks into the new year, a nurse stuck his head into the treatment room where she and Kincaid were putting the finishing touches on a laceration and said, "Boss, just got word from an advance scout. Hank and them's coming in hot. Found someone in an old barn by Oren." "We know how bad?" asked Kincaid. "Sounds septic. Wound infection. Looks like a bite." He paused. "Boss, they say he's a spared." At that, she almost gasped. Her first thought was that Tom had been bitten. Could it be? No, it couldn't be Tom. Too much time, nearly 2 months, had passed. "Get me a gurney for out front and get a tech in here now.
I'll be right there," said Kincaid, and then to her, "Go on, finish up. We don't got all day."
"Sorry."
She concentrated on that last stitch, then tied and snipped. She did it all calmly enough, but her heart was trying to break through her ribs. She reached for a packet of gauze bandage, but Kincaid was already stripping off his gloves.
Leave it," he said. "I need you with me."
He snapped his fingers at a tech, pointed at the patient, and was out the door with Alex on his heels. Dashing down to the lobby, they pushed out through the double doors as first a single rider thundered down the approach road, followed an instant later by a horse-drawn flatbed sleigh. A man she didn't know, but who must be Hank, was handling the horses. Alex spotted two boys in the sled. With a little stab of surprise, she recognized Greg. What was he doing here? He'd gone out with Chris. All thoughts of that vanished when she realized that Greg was doing CPR.
"Whoa, whoa!"
Hank shouted as the horses charged around the breezeway. He pulled back on the reins hard enough that one of the horses reared in protest.
"Whoa! Easy!"
The two horses stamped and jolted to a shuddering halt, and then Kincaid was dashing for the sleigh, hoisting himself onto a runner.
"What do we got? How bad is he?"
Then he got a good look and said, "Oh, Lord." Heart jamming into her throat, Alex crowded in beside Kincaid, and then didn't know whether to sob with relief or fury. It was not Tom. Of course it wouldn't, couldn't be. The boy was young, no older than 8 or 9, and Greg had ripped open the boy's jacket and shirt to do CPR so she could see the birdcage of his ribs and the knobs of his shoulders. His eyes were closed and sunken, and he was deathly pale, his lips almost blue. The right leg of his jeans was shredded and oozy, and the smell was overpowering. Her breath thinned as she caught his smell, rotting and fetid.
"Found him by his lonesome in a barn. Arrested on the road," Greg said, without breaking stride. He was sodden with sweat, breathless from exertion. "Been at this about 4-1000, 5, go."
At his signal, the other boy who'd preceded the sleigh up the road, she thought his name was Evan, squeezed an ambu-bag, forcing air into the unconscious boy's lungs. Greg ducked his head into his shoulder to smear away sweat. 10 minutes now.
10 minutes too long, Kincaid said.
He turned as Paul, an elderly male nurse with a permanent beer belly, rattled up with a gurney.
"I got this, Paul. I want IVs set up, large bore, and get me a CVP line."
"I don't know if we got one, boss. We're so low."
"Find me a damned line, Paul. Don't you show your face without one, you got that? And get out the crash cart, whatever you can scrounge. Move it!"
As Paul hurried back inside, Kincaid wrestled the gurney alongside the wagon, butting it in place with his hips.
"All right, people, bells and whistles on this one. Let's..."
He paused, a curious expression creasing his weathered features. Hank, who'd already leapt down to help move the injured boy to the gurney, looked over at Kincaid.
"Doc, you okay?" "Yeah, just a sec. Greg, hold up there. Let me check for a pulse."
And then Kincaid stared right at her, grabbing her eyes, and she read the question as if he'd spoken it aloud.
"Is it safe?"
It was a question she knew would come eventually, one they'd never asked before.
"Is there a pulse?" said Greg.
Kincaid didn't answer. She knew she couldn't afford to be wrong. The dead meat stink was unmistakable, but it was all so different, gassy and almost sweet.
"Doc?" Hank asked.
"Dead meat, yes, that's infection, not the change."
She gave Kincaid the barest of nods.
"I'm not getting anything, Greg. Keep on those compressions." "All right, let's go," Kincaid said. "Move him on 3. 1, 2...
Straddling the gurney, Greg continued CPR all the way to the treatment room as Evan trotted alongside with the ambu-bag. She and Paul started the IVs, and Paul had found a CVP line somewhere that Kincaid now threaded into the boy's subclavian vein.
"This is the last of the bicarb," Paul said, handing Kincaid a syringe. "You sure you want to?" "Can't think of a better time. Push that on in there. We got atropine? All right, hold on. Greg, stop compressions."
Eyes closed, Kincaid listened through his stethoscope, then said,
"Hold on, I think... Paul, push that atropine in."
They waited. Greg was panting, the sweat running in rivulets down his neck. Paul glanced at a stopwatch.
15 minutes, 20 seconds, boss." "I got something,"
said Kincaid, glancing at his watch now and counting under his breath.
"Paul, get me a BP."
60/30, boss."
"All right, that's not great, but it's not terrible. This boy might make it after all."
Kincaid snapped on a pair of gloves. Let's see what we got. Alex, I need your hands. Glove up.
The stink that pillowed from the boy's left thigh smelled of rot and was bad enough that even Kincaid winced. Someone had tried to bandage the wound, but the wrappings were soggy and stained green and yellow with pus. Alex felt her stomach turn over as Kincaid peeled away the oozy gauze wraps. Pus, yellow-green as snot, puddled in the open wound, and the shredded flesh along the wound's margins was black. Thin red streaks coursed the length of the boy's thigh to his knee and radiated to his crotch. 75/40.
All right, Kincaid said as he began sponging away the mess with gauze pads.
On the gurney, the corners of the boy's eyes twitched, and then he let out a low moan.
I know, Kincaid murmured as he worked. I know it's bad, son. I'm sorry, I know. You just hold on there.
That's good, right, Doc? His pressure? Asked Greg, arming away sweat.
Well, it's not bad. You boys catch a name before you hightailed it out of there?
No, like I said, he's been out of it.
Okay. Alex, draw up a couple 50cc syringes of saline and irrigate the hell out of this, would you?
Alex was glad for something to do. As she pulled up the fluid, Greg said, You can save him, right?
We are certainly going to try. He might lose that leg, but one thing at a time. Greg, get yourself into some dry clothes before you catch your death. How's that arm of yours? Either you boys hurt?
Nah, everyone got out okay, Doc, said Greg, flexing the arm where he'd been wounded 3 weeks before.
Good. I didn't want to be patching you up again. What about the others?
They're about a day behind.
All right. Now, you two get on out of here and let me work. Paul, get me a surge kit. We're going to be doing some cutting here, and I want some Cipro in him right now.
Paul pulled a small glass vial from a mostly empty med cart.
Boss, that's the last of the Cipro, I know. Just do it, Paul. Alex, you can stop irrigating. Cut away the rest of his clothes so I can see what I'm doing.
Kincaid glanced at her over his mask.
Let's just hope this poor boy stays out.
As Kincaid cleaned and debrided the wound, she worked a pair of heavy surgical scissors through the boy's pants, cut those away, and then attacked what was left of his shirt, slicing through